Welcome to the Friday, May 24th, Memorial Day weekend episode of On Iowa Politics. On this week's podcast, Governor Kim Reynolds puts the final touches on the 2024 legislative session and the latest on Randy Feenstra's Republican primary. Hello, everyone. I'm Aaron Murphy, the Des Moines Bureau Chief for the Gazette in Cedar Rapids. With me this week are Gazette Deputy Bureau Chief Tom Barton. Hello, Tom.
Hello, Aaron.
Lead Des Moines Bureau Chief Caleb McCullough is with us. Hello, Caleb.
Hello, Aaron.
We have Jared McNett of the Sioux City Journal. Greetings, Jared.
A full recovery and some measure of peace and comfort for the folks in Greenfield.
Man, amen to that. Amen to that. And lastly, we have Gazette columnist Todd Dorman. Hello, Todd.
Hey, Aaron.
All right. And before we get into this things this week, Jared already said, obviously, all our thoughts were with the folks in Greenfield and their recovery efforts there. And also, we wanted to make a quick note that last Friday, after we had taped last week's podcast, Iowa Senate Majority Leader Jack Whitfer announced that he was recently diagnosed with a brain tumor. Whitfer said he is receiving radiation treatment and that he does not plan to step down from his role leading the majority Republicans in the Iowa Senate. So obviously we hope for the best possible health outcome there for Senator Whitfer. Okay, first up this week, speaking of the legislature, the 2024 session was officially completed this past week when Governor Kim Reynolds took action on the final batch of bills that had been passed by the Iowa legislature. In that last bunch were some pretty big signings, including on traffic cameras and hemp products. But perhaps most interesting was the lone veto from Reynolds on legislation that was designed to address Iowa's open meetings laws. We talked about this on last week's podcast too, but at that time, the governor had not yet acted on the bill. We were wondering whether she was going to sign it or veto it. It turns out she did veto it. So Caleb, quickly give us the synopsis of how we got here and your reaction to Reynolds' lone veto.
Yeah, so as you said, we talked about this last week, so I'll try to give the briefest explanation I can about the conflict here. But it was a bill that was seeking to increase the penalties for violating Iowa's open meetings law. An amendment was added at the last minute at the end of the legislative session that was intended to offer more clarification or a different type of exemption from Iowa's open meeting law for attending a political or civic event that is hosted by a political or civic organization. The way the amendment was worded, public government experts and advocates worried that it would actually not just allow people to attend those events socially, but allow these boards and appointed bodies to hold private meetings that are hosted by these groups and deliberate on public policy, which is the whole spirit of the open meetings law, is to not allow that to happen. So that concern was raised in debate as well as afterwards, but it was passed by the House and the Senate. And then the concern was raised by public meeting or public open government transparency experts, and Governor Reynolds did eventually veto it. And in her veto letter, she kind of indicated that she had those same concerns. And she said that the amendment would make the open meetings law too ambiguous and unclear. And she said, you know, the law needs to be clear or else it is impossible to enforce and inconsistent to enforce. So that was kind of her rationale for vetoing the law. And she said, you know, she still wants the legislature to work on this and hopes, you know, they can work on something in the future. And that's kind of the reaction from some of the lawmakers that worked on it. You know, Representative Brent Segrist, I spoke to, said, you know, he wants to come back next year and work on it. Representative Gary Moore is the Republican from Bettendorf who introduced the bill. And he was pretty upset that the bill got vetoed. You know, he said that he didn't hear those concerns while it was being brought up, but he said, you know, if those concerns were there, he didn't see why the law couldn't be signed, and then they can come back next year and address that after they get those penalties put into law. That was kind of what he thought would have happened.
Which I get that frustration, but my response would be that would be, well, what happens over the course of this year then until that bill is signed, and does someone abuse that loophole over the next, you know, 10 months or whatever until next year's session?
Yeah, and what's the guarantee that, you know, lawmakers are going to be able to roll it back? It's a lot harder to stop it from going to law than it is to go through the whole process and bring it back out. Yeah. So yeah, that was kind of the attitude, and he was less excited about coming back and doing it next year. He said, you know, this was the year, this is the chance to do it. And so he was a little disappointed.
Interesting.
Caleb, you mentioned Brent Seagrass, and I was reading your story, and he was saying that he thought the House version of the bill was stronger before the Senate lawmakers amended it. And that read to me a little bit like a recrimination now that the legislation has been vetoed.
Yes. Yeah, definitely. Because part of that last amendment was also taking out a piece of the bill that required training for members of elected or appointed bodies to, you know, make sure that they knew the rules of the Open Meetings and Open Records Law. So yeah, he said he wanted that to be back in again. And definitely there's not a lot of, there's a lot of blaming going around, fingers being pointed.
And Caleb, remind me, I believe, did I see in Reynolds' veto statement, she mentioned the training as well. Did she not? That she was also disappointed to see that that had been taken out of the bill. Am I imagining that?
I think she did, yes. And I don't have the statement pulled up right in front of me, but that does ring a bell.
Yeah. So that was interesting. And to that point of the House liking their version better, that was one of those bills that was taken up in the second to last day of the session. And what wound up being the troubling amendment was added to the bill on the floor during debate in the Senate. So Senator Webster, who brought up the amendment, will say, and he did to me in my story, say, look, that proposal has been around, which is true. I he's right about that, but it hadn't been debated as part of that bill. It hadn't been considered as part of that bill, and it was lopped on at the last second. And that's the provision that got us where we are. And again, Governor Reynolds has not vetoed much of anything over recent years. And I should have thought of that question before I came on today. To look back how many times it's been, obviously since the trifecta, there's not as much of a need for that, but it hasn't been very often. So that was a pretty noteworthy thing there.
I was looking the other day, and I think there was one veto last session and maybe one the session before that as well. So it's definitely rare.
Yeah.
Is there like a giant V stamp that has to be like dusted off and like ka-chow, you know, down onto the... to the legislation?
He turned to Colin Crompton and said, oh, Colin, we almost made it. Grab the V stamp. We need it for this one. Oh, man. Yeah, that's that was, again, I apologize if to you all listening if you were bored with that one, but I thought that was so interesting the way that played out. It was worth talking about again post-veto. Another one of the bills to mention here that was signed down the home stretch was the latest redesign of the state's mental health care delivery system. And I say that some of us are just old enough to have been around when they did that in 2013. And now they're doing it again and combining the system with the behavioral health care system. Tom, you covered that bill signing. You were part of an Iowa Ideas discussion on the topic as part of our Iowa Ideas discussions at the Gazette. So tell us all about that.
Yeah. So as you mentioned, the governor signed that bill into law here on I think it was May 15th, middle of the month. She signed it here in Cedar Rapids at Foundation 2 Crisis Services. Essentially what the bill does is it combines Iowa's 32 mental health and substance use regions into 7 unified behavioral health districts while placing disability services under the jurisdiction of the Iowa Department of Health and Human Services. The proposal aims to improve a system that both state officials and advocates agree is badly fractured. Each district will be required to provide a standard set of core services, ensuring consistent care statewide. The Department of Health and Human Services will define district boundaries and required services and will implement performance metrics and provide oversight of the system. The districts would handle prevention, education, early intervention, treatment, recovery, and in crisis services related to mental health as well as substance use disorders. Funding for those services would also be merged into one behavioral health fund overseen by Iowa HHS. Kelly Garcia, the state's director of Health and Human Services, who was on hand for the bill signing here in Cedar Rapids, said that for the first time, Iowa will have a intentionally planned system that includes in statute prevention, treatment, and recovery. That's something that Iowa advocates, you know, have praised and said that they are looking forward to that, you know, instead of having kind of this disparate system for people who are in mental health crisis and struggling with substance abuse, you know, oftentimes frequently, you know, those who are in mental health crisis, you know, also are dealing and struggling with substance abuse, you know, and vice versa. There's close connections, you know, between those two things. And so, you know, the governor talked about how, again, this is a opportunity to do better for Iowans who are in need, you know, and that bringing services together this way will enable better coordination of care, supporting hopefully, you know, what's intended to be the best possible outcomes for individuals, and also, you know, hopefully making it again easier and clearer for Iowans to know where to go and where they can access services. You know, again, whether it's a mental health issue or they're, you know, needing support for a substance use disorder.
And this is one, Tom, correct me if I'm wrong on this, that the advocates have been pretty widely in support of. That they say that, you know, it's a first step, it's not finishing the job, but they like the bill and what it sets out to do, correct?
Right. Emily Bloom, the chief executive officer of Foundation 2 here in Cedar Rapids, talks about the merger of the two regions is a step in the right direction to ensure that every Iowan has access to comprehensive mental health and substance use support. However, you know, it should be noted that some worry that the proposal does not go far enough to address underlying issues that hinder access to treatment and services, including Iowa Medicaid reimbursement. And, you know, they say that, you know, while the change could be a win for how mental health and substance use services are administered in Iowa, again, there are still these underlying gaps in care that persist. You know, rural Iowans often face long drive times to seek treatment or struggle to access telehealth in sparsely populated areas where internet connections are weak. Children can't use Iowa access centers like those in Lynn and Johnson counties, and there's a limited supply of crisis beds and shelter space. It also should be worth noting that, you know, asked about that, Kelly Garcia, the Health and Human Services Department director, said that, you know, the department is considering building out a pipeline for providers and brick and mortar spaces to handle complex behavioral health needs, including launching certified community behavioral health clinics. She also emphasized the importance of, you know, having a comprehensive approach to addressing social issues and, you know, recognizing that a single solution is not going to be sufficient.
All right. Now that was a big one. Caleb, bring it back to you here because you put together a story. Now that we're all completely officially 100% done with the session and everything's put to bed here, kind of highlighting some of the noteworthy, kind of a look at the numbers view of the session and our new state laws. Give us a couple highlights from that, but not too many, so people still want to go read your story.
Yeah, so I just kind of tried to look at what was passed and break it down into some interesting little nuggets. There was 185 new laws total signed into law this year. That's counting, that's not counting the one that was vetoed. So 186 bills were passed, and there were also two joint resolutions to add amendments to the Iowa Constitution. Those don't need to get signed. They're just stick around until next year, and they go through their whole process. Looking at kind of the partisanship of those bills, I picked kind of a random metric for that, but I looked at bills that got more than two-thirds of the votes from each from Democrats in each chamber. So whether you, if you, you know, draw the line at half, it would be less than this, but 137 of the, or sorry, it would be more than this, but 137 of the bills that were passed were bipartisan by that metric, and 48 were passed with mostly Republican support.
And say those again, Caleb, because I think that might surprise some people how big the bipartisan number and how small the single party number was.
Yeah, and this is something that I think lawmakers say a lot when they're talking about this stuff, right, is that most of the work they do at the Capitol is bipartisan. So, you know, a lot of these bills that were passed dealt with, I almost said sewers and storm drains, but those can even be partisan. But, you know, things like that, things that aren't super controversial and just kind of, you know, changing various regulations and laws and that kind of thing. So, yeah, I was trying to do the math here quick, but, you know, a little... less than a
74%.
I did the math
earlier. Yep. The back of the napkin math is from there, Jared. Thanks, Jared.
Yep. So a little more than a quarter of the laws were partisan, but most of them, yeah, were bipartisan. The other thing I'll note is the this is, you know, the Legislative Services Agency has a page that's for the real law nerds out there. It has cataloged every single change to Iowa code that was instituted in the bills that were passed. So that's one by one, you know, some laws, some bills might have hundreds. And so the total number of those changes is about 2,870. And there were 255 new sections added, and sections were repealed 422 times. So Republicans like to talk about small government and simplifying Iowa code. And I think they made some progress on that this year. So yeah, that kind of thing. Yep.
That's a good one too, Caleb. I like that because it's easy to kind of get lulled into the idea that a bill changes one piece of the state law, and that's often obviously not the case. Especially some of the bigger bills that can change literally dozens of places in Iowa code. That's good stuff. And, so,
and every year there's a bill, a law that does non-substantial corrective amendments to code that the Iowa code editor catches while they're going through the laws, the code. So that's, you know, was probably a few hundred right there.
That alone,
was
just, you know, right? Kind
of grammar and stuff, right?
Right.
How many pages for all of those laws do we know?
That I don't know. I haven't, I don't know. I didn't know if there was a tool to do that, but I did not do that by hand. So I'm not sure.
Challenge accepted?
Yeah.
All right, moving on, we're going to dig a little bit back into Western Iowa politics, where our Jared McNett is reporting on the Republican primary in Iowa's 4th Congressional District. Jared, this past week, you actually interviewed both of the candidates. So was there anything that jumped out to you during that process? And of course, please don't forget to tell us when we should watch for your coverage in the Sioux City Journal.
Aaron, you don't have to tell me to shamelessly promote something. That's second nature. Yeah, we're going to have a 4th Congressional primary story dropping 5 a.m. May 30th, as well as a preview of the Iowa House District 13 race, which, even though that's more local, I still think is interesting because you have two first-timers who've literally not run for any other public office. Running against each other for a seat that was held for one term. I for the 4th congressional primary, I interviewed Randy Feenstra and his opponent, Kevin Virgil. The interview with Feenstra came as he's been endorsed this week by the Republican Jewish Coalition, which Tom wrote about. And Feenstra touted that during the interview with me. And their endorsement was interesting in part because they mentioned Kevin Virgil being endorsed by Steve King, and the Republican Jewish Coalition said King had a pattern of, quote, condoning white supremacists and anti-Semites. And I asked Feenstra about King supporting Virgil and about King and Virgil calling a Feenstra ad a, quote, montage of lies. And Feenster said, it's very shameful, the rhetoric and lies as they continue to go down that path. And then during my chat with Virgil, I asked him what differentiates him from Feenstra. And he said, point blank, I don't lie every time I open my mouth. Wow. So I think that's probably the top line. these two campaigns are definitely beyond just highlighting differences in policy positions.
Man, my goodness. So yeah, definitely watch for Jared's story. That's just the teaser there.
I knew there was going to be some kind of slam when I asked Kevin Virgil like what differentiates him, but even I like winced a little bit. I was like, that's cutting right to the point to say I don't lie every time I open my mouth.
Wow. Tom, Jared mentioned that you wrote about that endorsement. Was there anything else that was part of that endorsement that was interesting, or Jared covered pretty well there?
I think Jared covered it pretty well. Although I mentioned to my editor he mentioned the statement from the Republican Jewish Coalition, you know, where it said that when Steve King represented the district, you know, they contend that he was a source of what they say to be constant embarrassment for the GOP because of his pattern of inflammatory rhetoric condoning white supremacists and anti-Semites. And I did some research to kind of look into that and, you know, look into, you know, past instances when King was in Congress. And I told my editor, you know, hey, if IT is kind of flagging and wondering why I visited certain websites like, you know, the Daily Stormer, you know, this is why. All right. Like,
I love that because that happens every so often, right? As a reporter, you'll have those stories that you're working on, yeah. And then you're doing your research and you think to yourself, I hope the FBI knows what I do for a job, because otherwise they're going to be a little concerned about my search history, right? Today.
Yeah. What were you doing searching for a far right Austrian party with historical Nazi ties?
See, this is why when I search anything, I put in parentheses at the end for research, and then I don't ever have to worry about getting in any kind of trouble. Just put that right at the end there.
Oh goodness, good stuff. All right, so real quick and jarring 180 turn here. I apologize for that, but we're a little shorter than usual because we cut a segment where they were playing. We were planning on talking about and the some scheduling changed, and the reason for that is what I'll touch on real quick. Now, let me just bring up the tornado in Greenfield here just really quick. And Todd, let me ask you, because when I saw those images, one of the first things that, first of all, they're obviously heartbreaking. And one of the first things that came to my mind is some of the bigger tornadoes that we've seen. And I wrote this in the newsletter one morning, like there's a famous one that, when I was growing up in Southwest Wisconsin in a town called Barneville that just did massive destruction to that town back in 1984. Obviously here in Iowa, everybody who was around remembers Parkersburg in 2008. And I'm wondering if you have any recollections of that storm, Todd. And were you with the Gazette by 2008?
Maybe. I can't remember for sure. I don't think, yeah, I think I was at the Gazette at that time. I was at like a Memorial Day grill out with a bunch of people whose families live in Parkersburg and New Hartford. Oh, wow. And people over there. So we just sort of watched it unfold. My hometown got hit in, wow, 1966 by an F5.
Oh my gosh.
And the weird thing about it is it hit on October 14th.
Oh wow.
It was the same day as homecoming. Luckily the tornado hit like about 30 minutes after the parade had ended, there would have been a lot of people caught out. Just one of those weird 80 degree days in October. And I also kind of remember the pictures from Greenfield reminded me of a tornado in way back in 1968 in Charles City that just looked like they'd dropped a nuclear bomb on the town. I mean, there just wasn't anything standing.
And That one, like, because I had to cover Charles City when I stole over Mason City. That one, even like 50 years later, plenty of people, that one, like, didn't go away in terms of memories of.
Yeah, and it, I mean, there are photos of it. Like, everyone could see it coming. I mean, it was coming across, like, the Floyd County Fairgrounds. And, yeah, and it went straight through, demolished almost the entire town. So, yeah, there's been, you know, a lot of bad tornadoes, which I guess is the nature of living in Iowa. But this season, I think I saw a headline that said Iowa's had more tornadoes than in the other state at this point. So,
I believe it. It's been remarkable so far this year.
So take that, Oklahoma. No, I'm not happy. I'm not happy. We're number one on that.
There was a note.
Sorry, Jared, really quick. That reminds me of the old Simpsons joke where Springfield gets named the fattest state in the country, and Homer goes, "In your face, Milwaukee."
There was a note in an AP story today that I think April was the second busiest month ever for tornado activity since they started first monitoring that.
Wow. Wow. Great.
Yeah.
I'll share just really quick. One of the eeriest experiences I had as a journalist, period, but as a journalist covering storm damage, is when I was back at the Dubuque paper and there was a tornado that went through Platteville, Wisconsin. Man, what year would that have been? Late aughts, early tens, whenever it was. That's where I had gone to college at the University of Wisconsin, Platteville. And so I was there covering, you know, the kind of the aftermath the day after, and I'm walking through this neighborhood and the tornado had ripped through and completely obliterated the house that I lived in college for like 2 or 3 years. It was just gone except for like the foundational wall. So that was kind of creepy and eerie to see what it had done to that. And, you know, texting all my buddies with pictures and they're all blown away. It was pretty crazy. So
yeah, I not to go too far back in nostalgia, but I talked to a guy from Belmont who was a mail carrier at that time, and when the tornado hit, and he went missing, and they found him. He was pinned up against a telephone pole with grain bin metal wrapped around him.
Oh my
which,
gosh.
The good news is it held him upright, so he didn't bleed to death. But he was in a coma for like, I don't know, 6 weeks. And he eventually recovered. But his name was Maynard Holmgard, which I'm never going to forget that name because it's hard
great.
To forget. But
that's a great name.
But yeah, he
this was the Charles City one, Todd?
No, Belmont. Where I grew up. So,
oh, okay.
Yeah, he passed away several years ago, but he lived quite a while after that.
Wow.
Experience. Yeah. He said he didn't remember any of it. Just, I'm sure. It just happened. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is a total tangent, but since Todd mentioned Belmont, if anyone wants one of the best pork tenderloins in the state, go to the Belmont drive-in. Delicious.
It did win the title 1 year, and it's pretty good.
Good to know. There you go.
Right there on Highway 69. So skip old Interstate 35 and go north south on the old road.
As an Ankeny resident, I can endorse that. Stay over there. Who needs 35? All right. Well, on that note, and again, man, all the best to the people of Greenfield. We hope for a fast recovery and that we get no more bad news either. Hoping for all the best there. That'll do it for this episode of On Iowa Politics. If you're not already, please subscribe to us on your streaming service of choice or on YouTube. And I get to say it now. Smash that like button. I've always wanted to say that and actually mean it purposefully. You can also find the podcast each week on your preferred Gazette or Lean newspaper website. Give us the clicks. That's good too. Now that you've listened to the On Iowa Politics podcast, make sure you're also subscribed to the On Iowa Politics newsletter, where every morning in your inbox, you'll receive all the latest politics and government coverage from our team. You can subscribe to that free newsletter at the Gazette's website, thegazette.com. And lastly, don't forget that the work of everyone you heard here today, all these great stories we talked about, can be found on the pages and websites of the Quad City Times, Muscatine Journal, Cedar Rapids Gazette, Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier, Mason City Globe Gazette, Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil, and the Sioux City Journal. Spotlight by Chai Song Writer featuring Alicia Monet is playing us out this week. If you know an Iowa band or musician who should be featured on the podcast, please send us a sound file. For Tom Barton, Caleb McCullough, Jared McNett, Todd Dorman, and our producer Bailey Chihan, I'm Aaron Murphy. Thank you for listening.
Queen. Girl, you know I go hard, no Bluetooth. Throw 100 in the air, drop no Bluetooth. You the show, girl, 100% for intermission. Ignore your inhibitions, follow your intuition. I really wanna get you in the mood, baby, that's why this night's for us. Not a Gazette subscriber? There's no better time to support local journalism. View our latest deals for print and digital offerings at thegazette.com/subscribe. Stay informed. Be empowered. Subscribe to The Gazette today at thegazette.com/subscribe.